This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. So find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 245 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
Hey, man, I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Doing well.
Good.
We're back and ready to go in 2022. The holidays are behind us. How were yours?
They were good, man.
Yeah, mine too. Mine too. It was nice to have a little bit of a break on TCAT.
Yeah.
And spend a little more time with the family. So all in all, it was great. Gibbs, right now we have a good episode out on True Crime All the Time. We're talking about George Tiafoe, a firefighter in Las Vegas, who was convicted of paying someone to murder his wife, Shauna. I think it's a pretty good episode. There's a lot of very interesting, you know, kind of facts to the case. And you know, this guy, George, was very controlling. He was abusive. And I think he was one of those guys that just couldn't stand to let his wife leave, possibly go on to be with someone else. And he made the decision that he was going to have her killed. If he couldn't have her, nobody else could.
Yeah. And sadly, that happens more than it should.
Yeah. We've got some shout outs to give. Let's start with Patreon. We had Kiana Herrera.
Hey, Kiana.
Girthy Fish.
What's going on, Girthy?
Carly Clemens.
Hey, Carly.
Verdian.
Well, hey, Verdian.
Amy Dallas.
What's up, Dallas?
Asia.
Hey, we got the whole continent of Asia.
Jacqueline Lorenz.
Hey, Lorenz.
Tammy.
Good old Tammy.
Joseph Owings.
What's going on, Owings?
Rodrigo Alvarez.
Hey, Alvarez.
Kayla Groton.
Well, appreciate that, Groton.
Sherry Bandy.
Hey, Sherry.
Corinne Blake.
Well, thank you, Corinne.
Logan Clayton.
Hey, Logan.
Anna Bennett.
What's going on, Anna?
And Maria McLeval.
Oh, McLeval.
That's what I'm going with.
Yeah.
And then we go back into the vault. This week, we selected Melissa Escott.
Hey, appreciate that, Melissa.
Yeah, appreciate the new support, the continued support. We also had PayPal donations from Dana Mackey.
Hey, Dana.
Susan Pethall.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Jennifer Warmuth.
What's going on, Jennifer?
And Christy Della Certa.
Ooh, Della Certa.
So we appreciate those as well.
We do.
All right, buddy. Are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
I am ready.
We are talking about the murder of Jane Britton in early 1969. Jane's body was discovered in her two-room apartment in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The second-year Harvard University archaeology grad student and teaching assistant lived on campus. Jane had been brutally raped and struck in the head, sustaining blunt force trauma that killed her. A set of fingerprints was recovered from the crime scene. but no suspects could be identified. Despite receiving national publicity, the case soon turned cold and eventually fell from the headlines. But then in the late 2010s, with the persistence of reporters, and I think you had a lot of people from the online true crime community who were demanding access to case information, this case had a new development. Law enforcement managed to identify someone who hadn't even been on police radar before, but who had a history of committing violent crimes against women.
So I can tell this is going to be a good episode already.
Yeah, and this is one of those cases, you know, instead of calling it unsolved, a lot of times you'll call these cases unresolved. I like that word.
Right.
You know, I think we'll find out as we go along that, okay, technically it is unsolved, but there is someone squarely in the headlights.
Yes.
As being the perpetrator of this murder. So let's dive right into this episode. 23-year-old Jane Britton attended a graduate program at Harvard University, specializing in Near Eastern archaeology. This field is the study of artifacts from Iran, the Arabian Peninsula, modern-day Turkey, Cyprus, and North Africa, and the region between what is today modern Egypt and modern Iraq.
Very unique type of study. I really enjoyed my opportunities when I had to do this with my buddy Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I missed those days, but it was absolutely a lot of fun, but also challenging work.
Yeah. Hard work, thrilling, adventurous.
Yes.
I know you barely escaped bodily harm a couple of times. Yeah.
But Jonesy was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you said that all the time. But, you know, this was something that I guess I just really wasn't all that aware of that, okay, as an archaeologist, you would specialize in certain regions. I guess it makes total sense.
Sure does.
I guess I just never thought about it that way before. Having very little to no knowledge whatsoever of archaeology.
I'll teach you a few things.
Born on May 17th, 1945. Jane and her brother grew up with their parents, Jay Boyd and Ruth, in the southwest Boston suburb of Needham. Jane's father was the vice president of Radcliffe College in Cambridge, which at the time was a prestigious women's liberal arts college attached to Harvard. Jane's mother, Ruth, worked at Radcliffe, and she specialized in medieval history.
That's an interesting subject right there.
But it is, I think the other thing is that, you know, this was a very academic family.
Sure was.
So you're talking about Radcliffe, which I think back then a lot of girls aspired to go to Radcliffe because it was so prestigious and it was very hard to get in. But if you got a degree from there, okay, kind of sets you up for things to come. According to the New York Times, as a teen, Jane attended the exclusive Dana Hall School in Greater Boston, and it was said, Gibbs, that she wasn't just a brilliant student with a vibrant personality and quick wit. She was also artistically talented, becoming an accomplished pianist and organist, and she enjoyed painting. She had a love of horseback riding. I mean, sounds like she was good at a lot of things.
Yeah.
She was very well-rounded. Upon graduating from high school, Jane studied anthropology at Radcliffe, where her mother was on the staff. Jane's efforts saw her graduate from college magna cum laude in 1967. So no doubt, Gibbs, she had a very promising future.
Certainly.
She was destined for great things when accepted into Harvard's graduate archaeology program to work on her doctorate. Jane worked hard towards her academic goals, and in the summer of 1968, she accompanied senior academic staff to southeastern Iran on a field trip. At an archaeological dig site, the group found what was believed to be the ruins of an ancient fortress known as Alexandra Karmania, which had been taken by Alexander the Great.
Now, how cool would that have been?
Well, I think it was a very exciting moment for Jane. And that group, it had to have been. Like many Harvard students, Jane lived in campus-owned housing, an apartment building on University Road. a couple of blocks down from Harvard Square. When Jane wasn't hard at work at Harvard, she could be found at home with her pet turtle and her cat named Fuzzy. Her love of artistic pursuits continued throughout grad school, and she kept up with her painting and playing the organ. When she wasn't at home writing academic papers, Jane could be found spending time with her friends and classmates. This included her boyfriend, James Humphreys, and neighbors Don and Jill Mitchell.
I wish you knew how to have a good time, too.
Well, and that was one thing I was going to point out. She was obviously a very serious academic.
Yes.
She studied hard. She got good grades. She was goal-oriented, right? She was pursuing this goal, and she wasn't going to let anything stand in her way. But at the same time, she was obviously outgoing. She had friends. She had a boyfriend. So she, in my mind, was striking a good balance.
Yeah.
Between working hard, studying hard, and having a good social life.
Which is not that easy to do sometimes.
Some people can't do it, right? Some people have to go all in on the pursuit of their dreams and sacrifice some of the kind of the personal side of life. Don and Jill Mitchell lived in the apartment next to Jane's, so she often had dinner there. According to the New York Times, Jane became good friends with the couple. She even played the organ at their wedding. On January 6, 1969, classes resumed at Harvard following the Christmas break. According to Boston 25 News, that evening, Jane and her 27-year-old boyfriend James and some of their fellow students went out for dinner at the Acropolis restaurant in Cambridge. Afterward, the couple went ice skating at a well-known Cambridge park known as the Common, which was very popular with Harvard students. After their skate, they stopped in for a drink at a pub near Jane's apartment building. Around 10:30 p.m., James walked Jane back to her apartment. He left for home around 11:30 p.m., and Jane decided to pop in next door to have a nightcap with her friends Don and Jill. They later said that Jane seemed happy, and the group talked about their exams while they enjoyed some sherry together. Jane left Don and Jill's apartment around 12:30 a.m. She returned home, got ready for bed, and went to sleep. During the night, her killer entered the apartment.
So it appears that she had a really good evening up until she went to sleep, right? They went out to dinner. They had some fun with some friends. She got to have some sherry with her neighbors.
Yeah, they went skating. It sounds like a really fun night. It
didn't seem like she was afraid of anything, that something was disturbing her.
No, no. And I think that's important, right? Don and Jill later saying she seemed happy. She seemed upbeat. She wasn't telling them that she was afraid or she didn't look as though something was bothering her or something was on her mind. And Gibbs, the next day was set to be a pretty challenging one. So even though classes had just resumed, they had exams the next day, many of the grad students. This was one of the last course requirements the group had to get out of the way to write their dissertations as their new full-time course load. But Jane didn't show up for her exam, nor did she call anyone to say why. And like we say in a lot of unsolved cases, this was extremely out of character for Jane. We've talked about it, right? She was very disciplined.
An achiever.
She was an achiever. She was conscientious, not the type of person to just blow off these very important exams, not tell anyone about it, and just simply not show up.
Right. I mean, all the times you manage people in your career, you probably could immediately know who would always show up for work. And if they didn't, you knew something was majorly wrong.
Except for you.
Except for me.
I knew you'd be 20 minutes late.
Yeah.
According to the Washington Post, her boyfriend James tried calling her multiple times. There was no answer. Again, all of this was extremely unusual. Those who knew Jane knew something must have happened to her. For her to be unreachable, for her to have missed her exam, James went to Jane's fourth floor apartment around noon following the exam to check on her. There was no sign of forced entry, and the door was unlocked, but this wasn't unusual. Apparently, Gibbs, the lock was already broken. It was so unreliable, Jane didn't even bother using it. So James went inside, where he made a disturbing discovery. Jane lay face down on her bed. I think at first glance, she probably appeared to be asleep. But her blue nightgown was pulled up over her waist. On top of her body lay a rug and her fur coat, which obviously would have been pretty odd. James knew something was wrong, and he went next door to get Jill and Don. When the three of them entered Jane's bedroom to take a closer look, they quickly realized that something terrible had happened. Jane wasn't asleep. She wasn't even sick. She was dead. Her head was a bloody mess, and her mattress was stained with blood spatter. So in my mind, Gibbs, this is a very vivid scene.
Sure.
So I'm picturing James entering the bedroom. You kind of have that first sighting.
Right.
Okay, she's lying in her bed.
Yeah.
I'll wake her up.
Honey, get up. Come on. What are you doing?
I think very quickly, though, as you start to see the rest of the scene, things get stranger and stranger.
Sure.
You know, why is there a rug on top of her and a fur coat? And why is her nightgown bunched up, you know, above the waist?
Probably unbelievable.
Yeah. I'm sure it took him a while to even try to process what was going on. But the decision to go get, you know, the neighbors. I need some help here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I'm thinking must have been going on in his mind. I don't even know what I'm seeing.
I can't even comprehend it right.
Right. Now. I need some help. So I go get the neighbors, we come back, and then they discover more of the scene. And then it becomes pretty apparent that something really wrong has happened. Cambridge police and Massachusetts state police arrived at the apartment to seal off and process the scene. Officers soon determined Jane had been sexually assaulted before she was murdered. Detectives collected any forensic evidence available. According to the Washington Post, one of the first things officers noticed was Jane's body, the floor, the walls, and the ceiling all appeared to be covered in a light dusting of something which looked to them like fine dirt. But there really just wasn't all that much forensic evidence to go on. None of Jane's valuables had been stolen, and there was no sign of a potential murder weapon. The only other piece of evidence was a bloody cigarette lying in an ashtray. And I think, you know, what police thought was that Jane's killer was so cool, so calm, collected, that he'd either smoked during the attack or just after it.
That's definitely somebody not worried about anything.
Yeah, especially if you think about it occurring after the attack, after the murder. If you're going to sit down and smoke a cigarette, you're obviously not too worried about somebody coming home, coming to the apartment, discovering you inside.
Certainly no sense of urgency to get out.
According to the New York Post, two windows in the apartment were also found open. At the autopsy, it was discovered Jane had sustained a bruise on her arm, skull fractures, and multiple lacerations to her head. Toxicology results revealed that she had a 0% blood alcohol content. However, the alcohol content from her stomach lining was 0.08%. And this was really pegged as being from the sherry that she'd consumed at Don and Jill's place. I think the big thing about this is that it indicated Jane had been killed not all that long after returning to her apartment.
Yeah, it kind of helps them put a timeline together.
Yeah. According to Boston 25 News, Jane's cause of death was determined to be blunt force trauma, resulting from 5 blows to the head, which occurred around 10 hours or so before Jane was discovered. Her head and facial injuries indicated she'd been struck with something sharp, with a point at one end, something maybe like a hatchet, causing hemorrhaging. According to the Scranton Times-Tribune, Jane faced her attacker, when she was brutally struck in the head. So they knew some things.
Sure did.
But that didn't help them get any closer to figuring out who her killer might be. Some of Jane's neighbors told police they hadn't heard anything unusual during the early morning hours of January 7th. Further forensic processing of the crime scene yielded a set of fingerprints. And it was determined that they didn't belong to Jane, her boyfriend James, or her friends Jill and Don. Investigators looked at the lack of valuables taken from the apartment as an indication that robbery wasn't the likely motive. But there was one item that was missing, which initially could have been trivial, but probably also revealed something about the killer's intentions. Jill and Don Mitchell had previously given Jane a souvenir from a dig site. It was a small rock measuring, you know, something like 4 by 6 inches and had a pointed end.
Sounds like the potential murder weapon.
Yeah, I think the nature of Jane's injuries and the fact that the rock was missing led detectives to believe that it could have been, or maybe most likely was, the murder weapon. But the missing rock was recovered 3 days after Jane's murder. Now, we don't know really any specifics about how it was found. Cambridge police stayed pretty tight-lipped about the matter, aside from announcing that they'd found it. Around this time, the Cambridge police chief also announced that due to inaccurate information being reported by the media, no further comments would be given by any member of the investigative team.
Well, that's smart, right? Control the flow of information coming out of the investigation. How do you do that? You limit it to who does that.
Yeah, I think it's smart to control the flow of information. What I got here was that he got ticked because they were reporting inaccurate information. So sounds to me like he said, no, we're just going to shut it off. If you're not going to get it right, we're not giving you anything.
Yeah. How do you like that?
How do you like them apples? If you have ever wanted to make your home feel safer, there is no better time than now. Right now, our friends at Simply Safe are giving True Crime All the Time Unsolved listeners access to all their New Year's holiday deals. 20% off their award-winning home security, and your first month is free when you sign up for the interactive monitoring service. You've heard us talk about Simply Safe for a long time now. I've been using them personally for about 5 years, and I love everything about it. We love Simply Safe because it has everything you need to make your home safe. Indoor and outdoor cameras, comprehensive sensors, all monitored around the clock by trained professionals who send help the instant you need it. It was even named Best Home Security Systems of 2021 by U.S. News and World Report. You can easily customize a system for your home online in minutes and even get free custom recommendations from Simply Safe. There are no long-term contracts or commitments. It's a really easy way to start feeling a bit more peace of mind in the new year. But you got to hurry. Take 20% off your Simply Safe system, and your first month is free when you sign up for the interactive monitoring service. Visit simplysafe.com/TCAT today. Go to simplysafe-TCAT. True Crime All the Time Unsolved is brought to you by Progressive. What's one thing you'd purchase with a little bit of extra savings? Maybe a weighted blanket, a smart speaker, that new self-care trend that you keep hearing about. Well, Progressive wants to make sure you're getting what you want by helping you save money on your car insurance. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average. And customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. Discounts like having multiple vehicles on your policy. Progressive offers outstanding coverage and award-winning claim service day or night. They have customer support 24/7, 365 days a year. When you need them most, they're at their best. A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at progressive.com and see why 4 out of 5 new auto customers recommend Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary. Discounts vary and are not available in all states and situations. Further analysis of the dirt found on Jane's body when she was discovered revealed that it was either a red ochre powder or iron oxide. And I think this is a very interesting aspect of the case.
And you got to wonder how it plays into this case.
Yeah, I think it was a little baffling to investigators. In an archaeological context, the red ochre was commonly used as part of funeral rituals during the Neolithic age. So I think investigators at one point wondered whether this was some type of, you know, bizarre final act on the part of the killer. And if so, that would be telling, right? It would probably mean that Jane's killer knew something about archaeology, history, you know, those types of things. According to the New York Times, one of Jane's professors told police this piece of information would have been pretty common knowledge amongst the staff and Jane's fellow students. But investigators couldn't find any evidence that Jane had any type of serious run-in with anyone either during or after her trip to Iran, which could have resulted in her murder.
And I think that's the whole thing, you know, that she didn't have any issues with anybody. Who would want her dead? She seemed like she was a stand-up person.
Got along well with everyone.
Yeah.
But to me, this dirt is significant, right? It's like it's a dusting. We talked about it. It's found on her body, but found on, you know, other parts of the apartment.
Yeah, it could mean something.
Well, the very fact that it kind of has an archaeological connection, and that's what she's studying, the people that she would be interacting with on a regular basis would be studying that as well, most of them. So, yeah, you kind of have to say that most likely could be important. And obviously Gibbs, Jane's family and friends, they were devastated. Her friends couldn't figure out how anyone could have a motive to kill her.
Yeah.
Because like you said, she was just loved by people. She was easygoing. She got along well with people. She didn't seem to have any enemies. But police suspected that her killer may have been someone that Jane knew or had met during her studies. They made inquiries with students and staff attached to the archaeology department. And it makes sense, right? Really, aside from Jane's parents and her boyfriend and maybe her neighbors, those would have been the people who knew her best. She would have spent a lot of time with those individuals.
Yeah, it was like a second family. Kind of like you guys here at the Ferguson household.
Exactly, exactly. Jane's boyfriend, James, and her friends, Don and Jill, all passed polygraph tests. Police seized Jane's diary and contacted every person she mentioned in the diary to see what else they could find out. So they're really doing some work here.
Yeah, they're not slacking.
No, they also staked out her funeral services. They even filmed it so that they could then go back and look at the film and see who attended. Maybe look for someone who seemed out of place, someone who was hanging back from the crowd. This happens quite a bit. Now, this is 1969, but...
Yeah, we know that killers like to go back to the scene of the crime. Killers like to inject themselves into the aftermath of the murder.
Yeah, not only the investigation, but sometimes the funeral and things like that, because why? What would a killer get from going to the funeral? Some type of sick, perverse rush. Thrill, rush, knowing that they caused this,
yeah,
and they're now standing on the periphery of everything that's going on. They're feeling powerful because they're there and nobody knows that they're the killer. Now, I'm speculating.
Sure you are, but, yeah. But maybe they're relishing in the fact that all that sorrow at that event was brought on because of
their actions. Yeah. Jane's funeral was held in Needham 3 days after her murder. According to the New York Post, there were whispers amongst the student body that Jane had been having an affair with a professor who killed her after she threatened to expose him. And I guess, Gibbs, this was a rumor that persisted for a number of years. as far as I know, it was just that, a rumor. To my knowledge, there was no truth in it, you know, at all. No one was indicted by a grand jury that was convened in February 1969.
But in these unsolved cases, you're going to have a lot of speculation.
Sure.
You know, you're going to have rumors like this that will pop up. Doesn't mean they're true, but enough people talk about them. Sometimes they might seem true because everybody's saying the same thing.
Well, and one of the things that jumps out at me is oftentimes the rumors are not flattering at all to the victim.
No.
You know, if you think back through some of the cases that we've done, it's almost as if people start some of these rumors, and especially when we have a female victim, it's almost like they're saying, well, she brought it on herself because she was dating a married man, or she was doing this, she was doing that. Meanwhile, as far as I know, in most of these cases, there's nothing that ever comes out to substantiate the rumors. So again, we're probably not talking about the killer. Now you're just talking about people in general who get some type of gratification out of starting a rumor that really is very negative.
Yeah.
Towards a woman who has just been killed. Jane's murder attracted national media attention, largely due to her father's position and the fact that she was a co-ed at an Ivy League university. The 60s also saw some pretty well-known, high-profile crimes against women. You got Richard Speck, who murdered 8 nurses in Chicago in 1966.
That was a big one.
Yep, we covered him on TCAT. Then only a year before Jane's murder, the man who became known as the Zodiac Killer began his murderous rampage in California. That was 1968. And then we have the Boston Strangler, Albert DeSalvo, who killed as many as 13 women in Boston from 1962 to 1964. And we'll talk a little bit more about him specifically later, but that just gives you a little bit of an idea, the types of crime stories that people were reading about, that they were seeing on TV.
Talk about shocking.
Yeah. For the 1960s, these were very shocking crimes, very disturbing for people to see this stuff in the media. Now, as time passed with no new information, media outlets searched for any avenues they could to bring a fresh angle to the story. According to the New York Times, while Jane was at Radcliffe College, she was associated with students who were into the recreational drug scene. It was said that Jane didn't take drugs, but accepted her friends taking them if they chose to.
I think we've all been there.
Well, I know you have been there.
Yes, I have.
I think you should speak for yourself and yourself only. But this is the 1960s, Gibbs. Right. I mean, this is, you know, tune in, drop out, whatever. I mean, this is free love, drugs, rock and roll. Some of Jane's friends were worried that she might have found herself the target of unwanted attention by some of the new friends that she occasionally hung out with. They wondered if Jane had been killed by someone under the influence of a drug like LSD.
Well, I mean, LSD can make you do some weird things.
Well, and this was even reported in the student newspaper, The Tech, that some students thought this was a possibility. Folks, Gibby and I want to talk to you about Hi-Chew. This is a candy that makes me happy. It makes me smile. I think it'll do the same for you. Hi-Chew has the most amazing flavors, and they're true to life. Unlike anything else, there's no artificial flavor taste at all. Soda tastes like soda, and pina colada tastes like pina colada. Hi-Chew uses concentrated fruit juices and purees, so every time you place a piece of Hi-Chew in your mouth, you experience an explosion of flavors. And that's where the big smile comes in. Hi-Chew contains no colors from synthetic sources, and it's gluten-free. Hi-Chew has been created in over 200 flavors since it first launched in Japan in 1975. The flavors are outstanding. It also has the most interesting chew of any candy that I've ever tried. It's not gum. It's not taffy. It's just a chewy texture that's different from any other candy. We want you to love Hi-Chew as much as we do. Visit www.hi-chew.com/win. That's hi-chew.com/win. And enter to win an exclusive bucket full of Hi-Chew candy and swag. While you're there, check out how you can become a member of the Hi-Chew Chew Crew, which is an exclusive club where you receive special offers and all the cool things. Go to hichew.com/win. No one in Jane's circle raised any suspicions or could provide any information on anyone who could have been involved in her murder. Police also hit another dead end when they concluded the ochre or iron oxide found at the crime scene was most likely flaky pigment from Jane's artist paint, which was commonly available at the time. Now, one of the other reasons that this case received a lot of publicity was the unsafe nature of the campus accommodations. You'd think that prestigious universities with really high fees, like Harvard, would have had state-of-the-art accommodations available for those who wanted to pay for the benefit of a short commute to class. But in the late 1960s, this couldn't have been further from the truth. According to the Harvard Crimson newspaper, the building where Jane, Jill, and Don lived was pretty run down. It had poor security. We already mentioned that her lock was kind of busted. She didn't even use it because it didn't work correctly. Anyone could walk into the building if they wanted to, and they would have had no trouble gaining access to the apartments inside.
Well, look, I know that your daughter has been at a university for 3 years now. There is no way you would ever be okay with any scenario like this, that you can just wander right into the building, let alone if you got into the building, you could just easily walk into her dorm or apartment or whatever.
Yeah. And again, I know we're talking about the 1960s. I think people think Harvard.
Yeah.
You know, the cream of the crop, the upper echelon,
yeah.
Everything's fancy, everything's locked down. At universities today, security is much more important. It's taken much more seriously.
Sure.
You know, I know at my daughter's university, the dorms are kind of locked down and, you know, you got to have a pass to get inside and things like that. But I think the other thing is there had been an increase in violent crime where Jane lived in Cambridge. It was said that it was unwise to be on the street after dark. According to the Lewiston Evening Journal newspaper, in the months before Jane's murder, predatory individuals had taken to mugging unsuspecting students and staff around Radcliffe College dorms and the Common. And when she was a student at Radcliffe, Jane survived one frightening encounter. One night on the Common, she had been attacked by a man and managed to escape by using a pocket knife to defend herself. And I think this was scary for a couple of different reasons. Number one, just the encounter itself would have been scary.
Yeah.
But number two, this man was never caught.
And I know colleges and universities are targets for predators. We hear about it all the time.
Well, and we've also covered a number of cases where predators have specifically targeted colleges or universities. We just mentioned, you know, Richard Speck. You can think about Ted Bundy. You can just go down the list. There's a ton of predators who have, you know, targeted campuses because they know that there are going to be 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old females sometimes walking alone by themselves.
Yeah, plenty of opportunities.
Maybe at night, yeah. But all of these issues caused Jane to plan to move out in 1970. When police spoke to the rest of her neighbors, they did get some useful information. A resident nearby told investigators that they'd heard strange noises, which seemed to come from the fire escape outside of Jane's apartment. Another resident told law enforcement that at around 1:30 a.m. on January 7th, he'd seen a man running away from Jane's building. And he was able to give somewhat of a physical description. He said the man appeared to be about 6 feet tall and weighed about 170 pounds.
Again, I would never be able to do that. I would never be able to say how tall somebody was or what they weighed staring at a distance as they're running. I just wouldn't be able to do that. That's me.
I think you could do it. Now, would you be accurate? That's the key.
Yeah.
I think anybody can give a description.
Yeah.
It's how accurate is your memory and how accurate are you at estimating?
Right.
Right. This is not someone who's walking out of a 7-Eleven where they have the thing on the door that says 6 foot.
Right.
And you can look at the person's head in relation to the 6 foot. This is someone who might be on an upper floor, let's say looking down. Yeah. Those are tough.
Yeah.
Those are tough to do.
I mean, you're not going to be able to calculate those angles in.
Jane's case gained even more media attention after it was suspected that Albert DeSalvo, who had confessed to being the Boston Strangler, could have been her killer. When this theory emerged, DeSalvo was already serving time in prison. But Jane's case turned pretty cold. The amount of attention it received and media coverage dropped off.
Well, there just was no new leads, no new information coming out on the case.
Well, and that's what happens, right? That's why cases go cold. If you have nothing new to work, no new leads, no new tips, cases are going to go cold. When it came to Jane's case, the investigation was still open. Law enforcement wasn't forthcoming in responding to media requests.
Well, I think the media wanted to gain access to any of the information that law enforcement had from the original investigation, but law enforcement wasn't willing to do that.
Well, we already mentioned they weren't happy about some of the things that the media had reported, misinformation, and let's face it, Gibbs. I mean, you know, most of the time in unsolved cases, police don't give out all that much information.
Yeah, what they do have is probably critical for anything that could potentially come down the road. They might need that information to determine, is this our suspect or not?
In 1969, obviously we know DNA technology wasn't around, but despite this investigative limitation, detectives had enough foresight, enough training to properly preserve physical evidence from the scene. And the big piece of evidence they were able to preserve was the suspect's semen. In the late 1980s, once DNA technology was known about, it started to be used, investigators were excited to test the semen sample they had. Unfortunately, there was no match when compared to samples on file from known offenders. I can't imagine, Gibbs, that they had a lot of samples to match it to back then.
Yeah, probably clearly very limited.
Well, because we're in the very early stages of using DNA as a forensic tool.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know when the first databases came about, but I don't know that they were matching a lot in the late 1980s. Investigators waited about 15 years or so. And then retested the sample again in 2006, still no match. But you would have to think they had databases, obviously, by that time. They had a lot more to try to match it against. In the mid-2000s, there were more theories offered up about what happened to Jane. One theory was that Jane was killed by someone she knew from the archaeology department. Jane's body was covered up, which we've talked about before, Gibbs, sometimes indicates that the killer knew the victim.
I think sometimes these killers feel bad for what they've done to somebody they know, and they feel like maybe if they cover them up somehow, it makes it a little bit better.
The problem is there's really nothing to substantiate this theory. We already said she didn't have any known enemies.
Right.
There were no reports of, you know, things like professional jealousy from academic rivals, problems with, you know, teachers, supervisors, whoever it would be at the college.
And I just wonder if maybe it was a killer with a conscience.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I think in large part, that theory really kind of originates from the red ochre powder.
Yeah.
And the connection that people had or thought it had with the archaeology department and all of that. It's just never really kind of been proven, or there's nothing that's really come out of it. Another theory is Jane's boyfriend, James, and her friends, Jill and Don, had something to do with her murder, either individually or collectively. They were the last people to see Jane alive. But as we mentioned, all three parties took a polygraph test and they passed. Gibbs, I think we have to assume that police did their due diligence. Everyone had solid alibis, and James, Jill, Don, they were just weren't involved in any way. If you're a fan of romantic movies and love films with beautiful cinematography, then you're going to love Redeeming Love in theaters January 2022. Based on the international best-selling novel by Francine Rivers, the movie takes place during the California Gold Rush of 1850 and follows the life of Angel, who was the most notoriously sought-after woman in the Sierra Nevada foothills town of Paradise. Right as she was about to give up on finding freedom, Angel meets Michael and encounters a love that's unlike anything she's ever experienced. But shame of her past causes Angel to run away from the very thing she's always wanted. As Michael sets out to find her, Angel discovers there is no brokenness that love can't heal. Redeeming Love, featuring Abigail Cowan, Tom Lewis, Nina Dobrev, Eric Dane, and Famke Janssen, is rated PG-13 and premieres January 21st in theaters nationwide. So bring a friend or even your significant other to see Redeeming Love. For more information or to find tickets to a theater near you, visit RedeemingLoveMovie.com. That's RedeemingLoveMovie.com. And then I think we move on to one of the more interesting theories, which is the confessions of Albert DeSalvo. In addition to admitting to being the Boston Strangler, DeSalvo was said to have admitted to the 1963 rape and murder of Beverly Samans, a student who had lived in the same building as Jane. By early 1969, Beverly's case remained unsolved, but many believed that she was one of the Strangler's victims. But there is a major problem with the theory of Jane being one of DeSalvo's victims. In January 1969, DeSalvo was confined to a secure psychiatric hospital.
I do find it interesting that DeSalvo admitted to the 1963 rape and murder of Beverly Samans, that she lived in the same building that Jane would eventually occupy. I think that's really bizarre. I mean, the odds behind that happening.
Yeah, it's interesting, no doubt. And I think that's why DeSalvo gets brought in, right? Obviously, he admitted to doing a lot of bad things, but then you have this connection. Now, it's tenuous. It's years and years apart. But when you find out that there was very little chance he could have even been on the outside in the public at the time that Jane was raped and murdered, I think you almost have to discount it altogether. So if it wasn't DeSalvo and it wasn't someone who knew Jane, right? Boyfriend, neighbor, classmate, that really kind of brings us to the theory that a total stranger raped and murdered her. According to the Washington Post, when Albert DeSalvo was active, some people believed a copycat killer was operating in Massachusetts. Given the fact that DeSalvo was in custody when Jane was murdered, the stranger theory seems to be one of the more plausible theories. And I think there are some people who believe that it's possible that this copycat killer could be Jane's murderer. The intense media attention Jane's case received meant that the public's fascination with her killer's identity has persisted throughout the years. We've seen this happen with murders that have gone unsolved for decades. I think, Gibbs, people really become fascinated with some of these high-profile cases. We know there's a very big online true crime community. You've got amateur web sleuths. You know, these people dig into some of these cases.
And they keep them going and going.
Yeah.
Well, people want answers.
They do. And people want to solve mysteries. According to the Boston Globe, some reporters and amateur sleuths were so intent on getting to the bottom of who killed Jane that they filed lawsuits against the city of Cambridge. They wanted the investigation records in the case to be released to the public. In the early 2010s, reporters Mike Widmer, who had covered the case from the very beginning, Becky Cooper, a former Harvard student who went on to write a book on the case entitled We Keep the Dead Close, and subreddit moderator Alyssa Bertetto wanted to see if they could gain some traction on the case by requesting documents from the case file. The state police released little, if any, meaningful information. In response, the trio filed lawsuits, hoping that the release of more information would lead to a breakthrough. It had been around 5 years since the semen sample found at Jane's crime scene was last tested for a DNA match. So law enforcement decided to rerun the sample. Investigators also gathered DNA samples from people who knew Jane to rule them out as the killer forensically.
That makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
This time around, the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab had advanced techniques for DNA analysis at its disposal. So, you know, we're talking like 2017. DNA advancements had grown, you know, by leaps and bounds by that time. When the semen sample was run and compared to those available, there was a tentative match with a record on the FBI's national database. According to the Boston Globe, one more step was required for the match to be confirmed. So investigators got creative and they searched the genealogy website Ancestry.com, tracking down the suspect's brother. The man cooperated and provided the police with the DNA sample they needed. And this sample matched so closely with the unknown male DNA profile found at Jane's crime scene that there was only a 0.08% chance that the man's brother was not the person responsible.
That's some good stats there.
Yeah. I mean, that's 99.92, if I'm doing my math correctly.
Yeah.
I don't know if I am or not, but that's a pretty good percentage that this man's brother is the person that left that semen sample.
I mean, as an investigator, you got to be pretty excited, I would think, at this point.
Oh, absolutely. In 2018, almost 50 years after Jane's murder, Middlesex County DA and Cambridge Police had an exciting announcement. They announced that the DNA belonged to a man named Michael Sumpter. Sumpter was a convicted rapist who ended up doing time for raping two women. According to the Boston Globe, the second offense was committed after Sumpter escaped from a work release program while serving his sentence for his first rape in 1972. Sumpter's DNA was matched to three other unsolved cases in Cambridge from the early 1970s, two of them similar to Jane Britton. Two of the victims were raped and murdered, while the other remained an unsolved rape. According to Boston 25 News, Sumpter had lived in Cambridge during the 1950s as a child, and as a teen, had his first contact with local police. By 1967, his girlfriend lived in Cambridge, and he worked about a mile from Jane's apartment. This was the year Jane graduated from Radcliffe College. 3 years after Jane Britton's murder in 1972, Sumpter assaulted a woman at a Cambridge subway station, not far from where Jane had lived, and was eventually convicted of the assault. And it was reported, Gibbs, that at the time that Jane was murdered, Michael Sumpter was around 5'11" tall and weighed about 185 pounds. Now, we talked about the fact that it would be very tough to estimate the height and weight, depending on where this person was.
Right.
But this was very close to the description of the man seen running away from Jane's apartment on the night of her murder.
Yeah. I mean, not far off from 6 foot tall and 170 pounds.
Unfortunately, there was one problem with police identifying Sumpter as the killer. He would never answer the charges because he was dead. He died from cancer in 2001 at the age of 54. Cambridge police and the Middlesex County DA were satisfied that Jane's case could be officially closed, having identified the rapist and most likely her killer. It had been the longest running open unsolved murder case in the county's history. So Gibbs, you know, I think unlike so many unsolved cases that we do, we have an answer as to who the likely killer was, at least as far as law enforcement is concerned. But I think there are still questions, right? How did events on the night of Jane's murder unfold? Well, according to investigators, the likely scenario is that Michael entered Jane's apartment through an open window via the fire escape. Once inside, he raped her and bludgeoned her to death in her bed, then climbed down from the fire escape and fled on foot. One thing that was noted was that there was nothing to suggest that these two individuals knew each other. So, I mean, I think that goes directly back to the stranger murder theory.
Sure.
We talked about that. At one point, many people believed that that was the most plausible theory. It seems as though that turned out to be correct. And while this case isn't necessarily unsolved, I think you and I look at this case as being more unresolved than unsolved. But despite the official police line that the case is closed, Michael Sumter was never brought to justice, at least for the rape and murder of Jane Britton. He never had to face the consequences of what he did to Jane by cruelly ruining the life of someone who, you know, had incredible potential. So, you know, I think as we wrap up this episode, we talked about it, right? We mentioned the fact that the investigators felt good about Michael Sumter being the killer in this case, though he would never see the inside of a courtroom. He would never serve prison time for what he did. He certainly fits the profile of a serial rapist and, according to police, a murderer.
I think you have to give credit to the detectives and the forensics team back in 1969 to have the know-how and the foresight to collect the semen and make sure that they protect it for all those years, right? We hear so many times about how evidence gets destroyed over the years. And, you know, we're talking 50 years here.
Yeah, it's a long time. We hear evidence being lost, you know, evidence degrades over time to the point where in many cases, what should be really, really good evidence as far as DNA is concerned, it turns out they're not even able to get a viable sample. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you said protect, I'll add in the word maintain. I think you do have to give them a lot of credit because according to law enforcement, it really was the only piece of evidence that could be used to eventually, you know, help solve the case.
Yeah. This Michael Sumter, from everything that you read, was a really bad individual. Knowing that the police believe he was Jane's killer, I just think how tragic this whole case was. Someone that had so much talent, a bright future in front of her, and it was all stripped away. And it took over 50 years to find out who raped her. I mean, thank goodness we know who did that. We got that answer. And I think, you know, police believe that he's also the murderer.
Well, and let's face it, it's a logical conclusion to make.
Sure.
But, you know, at the same time, it is kind of sad that he didn't see the inside of a courtroom. He wasn't convicted. You can't say that he killed her because it's never been proven in a court of law. You can say that police believe it.
Sure.
But that part to me is always sad. Is it less sad than a 50-year-old case that has no leads? I would say it is.
Yeah.
Because at least we have something. But that's it, Gibbs, for our episode on Jane Britton. We got some voicemails. You want to check those out?
Let's hear them.
Hey guys, it's Jodie calling from the UK. When I first started listening a year and a half ago, I promised myself that I would join Patreon when I caught up. And then I couldn't get enough. So I went on to Unsolved and promised myself that I'd be brave and leave a voicemail when I finished that. So here we are. I just basically want to say thank you because you've got me through a lot. Work, runs, all sorts. If my kids or husband aren't around, you are. And it's like listening to my friends. It's amazing. And as I was calling, I thought I should probably give something back. So I'm not going to lie. I just Googled serial killers in Wiltshire. Because it'd be nice to hear something from around me. Nice is probably the wrong term, but you know what I mean. And Christopher Halliwell came up, possibly linked to 27 murders. That could be worth a little look-see for you guys, and I'd like to learn more about that, to be honest. So yeah, like I said, I just want to say thank you. I'm totally Team Tika. I love you both equally, and you just bounce off each other amazingly. So yeah, thanks again. Stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
Love it. Love the voicemail. Appreciate all the kind words. That's actually a name that I'm not familiar with, so we'll definitely want to look into that.
Yeah, sounds like a good case.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Gibby. My name's Pam, and I was just thinking about you guys. I'm going by the Jacksboro La Follette Caribou exit heading home, and I just heard you say today on your podcast that that's where your family is from, Mike. I'm going up about 5 miles to the Huntsville exit, which is where I live. Sort of made my day that you guys are from, or that you have family down here. I don't know. You know, just a small world, I guess. But anyway, you guys help me get through the day every day. I work at SL and make car parts for Ford. And it's usually 10-hour days, and I work from 5 a.m. till 3:30 p.m. Got off a little early today. You guys do a great job. I just wanted you to know that you have listeners really, really close to where you have family. I'm looking at about 3 inches of snow on the ground after it was 67 degrees yesterday, I think. Christmas Day was about 70. Anyway, I just wanted to tell you guys to keep up the good work and keep your own time ticket. I have to say, Team Gibby, but I love both you guys. Thank you for all that you do.
All right, appreciate the voicemail. Yeah, I spent a lot of time as a youngster in La Follette. Cool little place, Jacksboro, those places.
Yeah, same here, yeah.
Hey, Mike and Gibby, this is Shanda Beavers, and I'm just calling because I just got done listening to the Edgecombe episode, and at the end you guys were talking about the new generation and their slang that we may not understand, and I thought I would share my funny with you. My daughter is a school teacher, and in a group chat the other day, she typed, "Shots fired." That's not funny when you're a school teacher and your mom doesn't know that that's the new slang for giving some sarcasm. So anyway, just hoping you guys have a great 2022. Keep your own time ticking, and thanks for everything. Bye.
I definitely get that one because obviously my wife's a teacher.
Yeah.
If she texted me that, depending on what the context was, I would be very worried.
Yeah, you'd be in your truck headed that direction.
Yeah. But I also have heard that term for, you know, like somebody is coming at you or yeah. Somebody has said something that is like initiating conflict. I've heard that term used for that.
Well, you're cool like that.
I am cool.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. It's Megan from Lewiston, Idaho. I'm listening to episode 92 on Unsolved right now, and you guys are talking about ketamine. And you guys probably know that it pretty much makes you paralyzed, essentially. When I was younger and going through my juvenile trouble, I used to take a lot of ketamine to the point that I went into a K-hole. And a K-hole is essentially an overdose on Special K, and I landed myself in a mental hospital in Coeur d'Alene. So if you play my voice now, I would like to tell other listeners that it's not worth playing around with. That stuff affected my brain for the rest of my life on top of, you know, the other substances that I played with up until I was in my early 20s. So, sorry, this is kind of a stupid voicemail, but I'm just catching up slowly and surely on the Unsolved. I've already listened to everything Unsolved, but anyways, I love the podcast, and keep your own time ticking. Bye.
Well, first of all, Gibbs, I don't think that's a stupid voicemail at all.
Not at all.
I would call it almost a, what do they call those? A service announcement?
Yeah.
Public service announcement. Warning people against the dangers of messing around with some of that stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of times people think, you know, oh, I'll try this. It won't you know, what's it, what's the worst that can happen? Oh, she's telling you.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, you think about cocaine and Lynn Bias and I don't know. I mean, I've heard a lot of those stories growing up, and I think some of that is what kept me from doing certain things.
Sure.
Because you hear horror stories from people who at least say or whatever, they did something one time.
Yeah.
And whether it was crack and they got addicted, or it was Lynn Bias and cocaine and he died, or, you know, whatever, but
ruin their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think that's stupid at all. I think there might be one person out there,
yeah,
who would not do something just from hearing what she's saying.
So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, buddy. That is it for another episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
That's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in-store, on social media, and beyond. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/truecrime.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today.
Save